Okay. Good afternoon, Ms. Whitworth. The first questions are a set of background questions. And the first question is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Fayetteville, West Virginia, on November 7, 1927.
Okay. And how long have you been lived in Roanoke, or been a citizen of Roanoke, Virginia?
I first came to Roanoke in 1945 to work with Daddy after he had started the Tribune.
Okay.
Of course, I haven't been here consistently since then, but that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. And was that the first time you worked with your father at the Roanoke Tribune, or had you come? Or when he started the Tribune in 1939, right?
Yes, but he didn't. The publication, when we say he started in 39, didn't mean he started rolling off the press.
I see.
Because it took a couple of years to work and get all of the equipment together and everything to actually start on a record. And that didn't actually come until 41, perhaps.
I see. So the paper's been published weekly?
Regularly since
1941.
He started it in 39, getting all of everything together. See, it takes a whole lot of equipment when you're printing it yourself.
Yes, ma'am.
Now you can start things and get somebody else to print it for you.
Right.
You can go with that.
Sure.
But in those days, it took a lot of getting things together to get ready to publish on a regular basis, which we've done for the last 60 some years.
Yes, ma'am. What were some of the obstacles that your father and you faced in getting the Roanoke Tribune published initially?
Well, I understand others had tried, you know, and started with before and since the Tribune or the black publications, but unless you plan it well, as he did,
yes,
and
ma'am.
He had worked on papers before coming here. But in those days, back in the 30s and 40s, you know, there were untold obstacles. Having to print it yourself, you've got to have the equipment, you've got to have the know-how, you've got to have the help to supporting help.
Sure.
And he managed to get all of that, and mainly through people at the Roanoke Times, believe it or not.
Okay.
They were the ones who helped us most.
Oh, good. Okay.
They were not our... because of their cooperation with us, teaching once, helping us to get linotype machines,
mm-hmm.
which was the process in those days, flatbed presses, and all of this stuff, you know, over a period of time, and then teaching us how to operate
them,
and this kind of thing was what helped us to survive. But the obstacles, I'm not familiar with them. Of course, there'd be financial obstacles,
yes, ma'am.
And this kind of thing, but there was a need for it, and
mm-hmm.
there was the desire for it. So
I
guess finances would have been the primary obstacle, which once you gain the confidence and trust of people, they're willing to, you know, go along with it.
Well, that's interesting, what you said about the Roanoke Times. I mean, they were fellow journalists, and so they were helpful. And
it was individuals. It wasn't the corporation
itself.
It was
individuals there.
But individuals within the paper who helped us right up to when we were moved over on Henry Street.
Okay.
There were... people that worked at the Times in recent years, if I got in trouble over there, all I had to do was call, and he would be right there in a matter of minutes to help me.
Right.
So they've just been in this, Tommy Powers and the different people that worked over there at the Bill Slusher, and there's a lot. I like to even call these names because they're people who remember
ma'am.
These people. And they worked, they were union people, and they used to put up at the Tribune down on Gilmer Avenue, you know, it was all glass.
Yes,
so,
ma'am.
They would put up newspapers around there so that they couldn't see the union people in there us get this Tribune out each week.
Oh, good. But that's very interesting.
It is.
Yeah,
people always want to tell you the problems they have and the bad stuff, but we've had a lot of support
from a lot
of good people, black and white.
Oh, good.
Especially the white ones.
Oh, good. Good. Now, Ms. Whitworth, when you got here, say from 1945 on to, say, like 1960, how was the Tribune primarily distributed?
Well, we've always primarily been distributed through mail.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize.
But mostly through mail, all of the ways by mail subscriptions. But that mail process, we used to stack all up. We used to label them and stack them all up and put them on the dock at the post office, and they work. Now we have to do all the post office's work. The more they charge us, I think it used to charge us $8 or $10 a week to get that paper, mail it out.
Yes, ma'am.
And now I tell you, it's unbelievable. We have to pay about $1,200 a month just to mail a few papers, and we do all the work.
Do all the work, yeah.
Any papers that, any six or more papers going to a certain zip, we have to wrap individually, label, do everything, sack them for the different distribution centers. When they leave the Tribune, they're ready for the Melrose branch or this branch. Yeah. We've got them sacked. We do all the post office work. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, that is amazing. And you pay more.
And pay. Oh, believe
me. Astronomical amount.
Astronomical amount. Keep going on. We have to pay by the piece, by the pound, by the percentage of advertising, by all of this stuff. It's unbelievable, having been in that business this long and see the changes.
Yes, ma'am. And not all the changes have been for the good.
Not really.
Were you an only child?
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, tell us about your brothers and or sisters.
I just have one of each.
You have one of each?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And neither of them is here. Both left, you know, home early. I was the only one that stuck around.
Yes, ma'am.
You always find one that'll stay home, ma'am, and kind of take care of the home buyers.
Okay. And do you have any extended family still living in Roanoke?
I never lived in Roanoke.
Okay.
Okay. I never had any family.
All right. When you were growing up, or when you came to Roanoke, what type of house did you live in? Where did you live?
Well, back in those days, you just got a room with somebody.
Yes, ma'am.
You know? So Daddy was had a room over here on Rutherford Avenue. And when I first came in 45, I stayed there also. And then I also got a room down here on, with the Spraggins down on the short end of Gilmer Avenue down there.
Yes, ma'am.
C.E. Spraggins, I think they have a lodge
name
for him now, but they misspell it. They spell it with two G's, and they always spell their name. For the record, they spell their name with one G. Charles Spraggins. I lived with them when I came here. The sweetest people you ever want to know.
Oh, okay.
They just had one son.
Yes,
Charles
Jr. Okay. And that was on short end of Gilmer
Dan. Very last house down there we lived.
Okay. Now, in addition to working with your father, what other activities were you involved in?
Oh, everything he was involved with. He was pastor at the time at up in Christiansburg.
Yes, ma'am.
And see, he went there in 19. We lived in Lynchburg. We were living in Lynchburg at the time that I was born, but Mama always went home, and that was where Fayetteville came
in.
Oh,
I see. Okay.
That was her home.
Yes, ma'am.
But we were residents of Lynchburg at the time.
Oh, okay.
And he had worked with printing down there also in at seminary down there.
I see.
At Lynchburg at the seminary. But, you were asking...
Yes, ma'am, about activities, like social activities, and I know...
you were asking where we lived here, and Daddy had been called from Lynchburg to pastor the First Memorial Baptist Church of Cambria. It wasn't Christiansburg then, and it wasn't Chafer Memorial. He changed it to that.
Oh, okay.
During his pastorate.
Yeah, okay.
And... when he left there 14 years later, it was Chafer Memorial Baptist Church. It was still in Cambria, which had its own political subdivision, just like Benton and all of these places, you know. But since then, I think it's all incorporated into Christiansburg.
Yeah. Okay. And when you were here, was your father and you, by extension, were you guys members of the NAACP or group? Activities like that?
I was a teenager then, so I wasn't really into all of that stuff. All I did was help Daddy I went back and forth with him to the church because we had to commute. We stayed in Roanoke.
Sure.
And we had to commute during the week for different services, and I played for his choir. Okay. And so we were just together all the time. Mm-hmm. And whatever he did, I was trying to back him up with it.
Okay. All right. Under the heading of education, tell us about your school life and where did you attend school and that type thing.
Okay, I did my first and second grade in Lynchburg, where we were living.
Yes, sir.
And then when he took the church in Christiansburg, then that was the first and second grade were my only public school experience. Because one in Christiansburg, they didn't have public schools for blacks.
Okay.
So we went to Quaker schools.
Yeah.
And that was Hill School, which was right on the church lot, practically.
Okay.
They've now turned it into a center. But that was where I went to elementary school from the third grade to the seventh grade. And Quaker schools only have 7 elementary grades and 4 high schools, so there are only 11 grades in the Quaker. So I went there and graduated from in Christiansburg Institute, also a Quaker school.
Yes, ma'am.
So I graduated from Christiansburg Institute when I was 16 and went to Bluefield State College.
Oh, okay.
Because of the, you know, shortness.
Sure.
And then I had started in Lynchburg when I was 5 because I was born in November, mm-hmm. and school started in September, but they let me start when I was 5.
Oh, okay.
So that made me come out in 11th grade
exactly.
at age 16 and go into college at age 16.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, Ms. Weaver, I would assume in Quaker schools or Quaker influence schools, there was, in addition to the academic subjects, a moral philosophy.
Absolutely. They were very similar to your public schools, you know, the curriculum
yes,
and
ma'am.
All of this. They just put more emphasis on education, you know, and on what's made it so interesting is most of my teachers and a lot of the others, most all of them came out of Roanoke.
Oh.
So although I always dreaded and always hated never having gone to school in Roanoke. There always seemed to be such a closeness
sure.
of the people who went through Addison and
exactly.
this kind of thing. And I that was one of my biggest regrets that I never did get to go to school in Roanoke. But having had all Roanoke teachers
yeah.
had the same, pretty much the same effect because they really produced some top students. When you come out of Addison, you went somewhere.
Yes,
and when you came out of Christiansburg Institute, a lot of them went straight into teaching because we had, it was just, like it said, an institute.
Okay.
It wasn't just a high school.
That's, yeah.
We had dormitories for boarding students.
Mm-hmm.
There was an agriculture department, a home ec building, all these separate buildings. And they taught the secretariat stuff and all kinds of it.
Yes,
it was
ma'am.
Just like a university,
yeah.
really.
Okay.
So when you came out of there, you were ready to go into the classroom as a teacher, or and some did. Some did.
Yes,
some went
ma'am.
Into teaching from there.
Okay.
But it was quite different experience.
Okay.
But all of our teachers, as I said, Ruth Clater, Roberta Clater, we had Ruth Dupree, we had Connie Johnson Hammer,
mm-hmm.
with all of these people came out of Roanoke, and
oh, okay.
I mean, they were excellent
yes,
teachers,
ma'am.
And they put out some products.
Yeah.
I mean, just like in this valley,
yes,
they
ma'am.
Did it up there at Christiansburg Institute.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know the people from here came up there to teach.
And they were very young, and they had most of them were out of Virginia?
Virginia State.
State.
Yeah.
20 years old, 21
yeah,
or
sure.
something like that. They were very young.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then at 16, you went to Bluefield State.
Uh-huh.
So now how was that experience different for you?
It was, let's say, brief.
Brief, that's right.
Because I hate to put this on tape, but I didn't make Thanksgiving.
Okay.
They kicked me out for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
I was a rebel. I've always been a rebel. And yes, I used to just run with the upperclassmen and initiating and doing things to the other freshmen. And
yes, ma'am.
It was a lot of crazy things I got into.
Well, that's okay. That was an experience as well.
Yeah, but it was, I really didn't want to be there. I had wanted to go to Hampton, and I guess it was finances or whatever. It just didn't seem like a college to me, and I just, my experience is a little different from most people my age. You see folks who, they were the only ones that made it into college.
Sure.
But see, I came from 5 sisters, all of my mother and all of her sisters who, my mother graduated from Ohio State in 1922.
Oh.
And they were all teachers, mm-hmm. you see, and the others from West Virginia State, from Oberlin, all of these, so all of them were highly educated. And when I went into school, we went in educated you see, so it was a little different. It's not just like being a street kid and rebelling and getting it. But I, when I went into the French teachers, my mother used to teach French and English, and when I went up there, the lady who was teaching me French was just butchering it, you know, and this kind of thing. So it's kind of hard, you know, it made it difficult.
Sure.
And I had to stop taking it at Christiansburg because that lady, and I can't call her name because she came running too.
Okay.
But, when you come from a whole family of teachers like I did, you're going in these places at a little different level.
Sure.
So that was one of the reasons for my rebelliousness.
Yes, ma'am. So you left Bluefield State. Where did life
take you?
Came
back. I went up there in 1944.
Yes, ma'am. And
it was in the, I graduated from Christiansburg in 1944.
Okay.
Then I went to, I went that fall to Bluefield.
Yes, ma'am.
And then when I came out of there, before Thanksgiving, I went to work at the powder plant.
In Rapid?
Up in Dublin.
Oh, in Dublin, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't old enough, but I didn't have any birth certificates or anything, so I just went to work. I always did look older than I was. So I guess it was in 1945 that the government people knocked on our door and said that they had a report that I wasn't of age, and I said, well, you can't prove it. And he says, well, it's not up to me to prove. It's up to you to prove you are.
Okay.
So, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
I couldn't. That was the end of my powder plant career, government career. So then I came down here and started working with Dad, and that was in summer of 1945.
Okay. And did you stay here? No, you mentioned earlier you didn't stay here continuously.
Stayed here a while. It was a little, Daddy wasn't the easiest person to work with. He was learning this linotype stuff, and I was trying to learn it too. The people were trying to teach me, but it was a little difficult. So I left and went to Dayton, Ohio. I got a geography book. And to pick somewhere to go, I didn't know anybody. I was so sick of everybody I knew. And I picked Dayton. Back in those days, 60 years ago, they had geography books. I don't know what you call them now.
Yes, ma'am.
But it had little dots for little towns and big dots for big cities.
So
I picked a medium-sized dot. I said, if the dot's too small, I can't get a job. If it's too big, I'm too country to get around.
Right.
So Dayton, Ohio. I picked Dayton, Ohio. I said, I never heard anybody in my life going to Dayton, Ohio or coming from Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
So I always remember I had saved up my little life savings through the summer of $50, I think it was. And somebody came and tuned the piano that week and charged us $20. So I paid him. I said, well, when Daddy comes, he'll give me my $20 back. No, he didn't. I didn't tell you to do it. So here now I have $30. And I walk down the hill to the train station to get my ticket to Dayton, Ohio. out of that $30. Really? And that was how, that was my introduction to the world.
Oh, really? So was dating a good fit for you?
I didn't stay there. Well, it was an amazing story because when I got, as I was leaving, my brother had called from, at the time, I think he was working with IBM in Poughkeepsie, New York. And so he just called and I told him I was leaving home and where I was heading. He said, oh, I was in the service with a guy from Dayton, and he gave me his phone number. So when I got there, I checked in the YWCA. Then they had rooms mm-hmm. you could stay. And I called this fellow. And so they came and got me and took me to their house for dinner. We were sitting out in the backyard, and a car drove through the alley there on the way and backed up, and the lady got out and said, Claudia Alexander. And she was from Fayetteville, West Virginia. I hadn't seen that lady since we were little kids, and she had married a teacher, and they were living in Dayton, right? And she recognized me, and she said, well, she went and got my clothes out of the Y and took me home with her, and I stayed with her until I got it.
Yeah.
So that's
okay. Yeah. God was looking out for you.
As always. Always. I wouldn't be here all the crazy things I've done if he wasn't right. I have kept him busy, really.
Well, under this heading, the next heading is life at home, and it says you talked about, you know, you were with your father all the time, and mainly he was a minister, and he was trying to get
do the
tribute.
Paper,
yes,
right.
Ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am. And so you inherited this entrepreneurial spirit from your father. How did you feel about that?
Well, my leaving home would be whenever we'd have a big falling out,
okay.
You know.
Yes,
then
ma'am.
I would go where I could learn more about the business. Okay. Because, so I left and went. That was how I got. When I went to Dayton,
yes,
I tried to get a job as a linotype operator.
Okay.
But you had to be union in those days. Mm-hmm. And here I was just a teenager and a woman. They weren't hiring women in that kind of a profession. So, I wound up, after not being able to find work in that profession in New York,
yeah.
I had a sister there, so I went up there where I got a job on the New York Age.
Okay.
Because
on the New York, wasn't
there? Age. The Amsterdam wasn't
print. Oh, okay, I see.
Wasn't
okay.
print, it's a newspaper.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am, okay.
The Amsterdam is more popular, but
yeah.
it's printed in Jersey. It wasn't printed
in New York.
York.
I see.
Still isn't, I don't think. If it even exists, I don't know.
Okay.
But there was a paper called the New York Age. In fact, who is it that, one of the, Ida Wells.
Oh, yeah.
Used to work on
it.
But she worked in the news, you know, in the office part. I never saw a newspaper office. I always worked in the dirty shops, you know,
yes,
the grease and graphite and hot lead. And
okay.
I didn't even see, and I didn't even come through the front door. I was always in that part of it. So learning how to do that composition part in that days, it was pretty rough and heavy and this kind of stuff. There were no women in it.
I was going to say, with the fact that you were a woman.
It was hard, and you had to be tough, and that's added to my toughness, you
yes,
know, because then the process, you only had, they called them magazines that you had to change fonts of type.
Mm-hmm.
You had to change foot, and these were heavy metal things that you had to lift from the ground and put up on top of it. And I would have to ask for help with some of that. And I used to hate to have to ask them to do anything for me. But that was where I learned really how to operate on newspapers in Ohio. I did work in Cleveland. I went to Cleveland. I kept going different places for different reasons. I would get a job on Cleveland Herald and in Columbus, what was the name of that one? One in Columbus, Ohio State Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was. And that was where I was getting my training. I'd come back because I couldn't learn from Daddy. You
yeah,
know,
I see what you're saying.
I'd go somewhere else and learn. And then I come back and try to help.
Okay. Was he receptive to the?
No. It was always the battles, but I could stick it out.
Yeah. So you were gaining experience to
absolutely.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Were there family stories that were passed down through generations? I mean, you talked about your mother and her sisters going, all being educated women. And you knew that was,
you know, our family, that's what's so odd about these educated families. They're not close like the other families that have to kind of depend on each other to make it.
Yeah.
And that was one reason I wasn't that attracted to education, because they were very formal with each other. It wasn't the loving kind of stuff you see with little close, uneducated families. And it just didn't turn me on. There was nothing about it I wanted to be like.
I see. Oh, okay.
So that was a part of my rebelliousness, I just said, this is education, I don't really need it.
And
they would just tell us, now don't associate with these, and don't do this, and don't do that. And I was always doing the opposite. I was always drawn to certain people and special people and trying to tend to daddy's people in Christiansburg that he didn't have time for because he lived down here. So it was just totally different for me.
Yes,
so no, we didn't have family. We were very formal. We, you know, had sat around the breakfast table and talked very little. And I mean, they lived in D.C. and different, you know, the sisters. And
yes,
when
they'd
get together, I don't remember seeing them even kiss each other, and greeting or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just formal.
Very formal.
Very formal. And there were two of them living in D.C., and one would visit the other on Sunday. You'd sit in the parlor, and one would serve you sherbet or something, just like a stranger.
Yeah.
You just can't imagine, so it just really didn't grab me.
Do you think that was the way that, say, middle-class blacks at that time felt you should act as middle class?
I think so.
Yeah.
I really think so.
Yeah.
I just don't know where they got that from, but it just didn't appeal to me.
Acculturated type.
Yes. And you had to dress a certain way, and I couldn't chew gum. Oh, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what Miss Pullen said at the band group. She wouldn't allow any of them to chew gum in her class, and she took some to the 61st
reunion,
class of 61 reunion.
Yeah, my sister's in that class.
Well, she said, okay. She says, I brought some packs of gum here today.
Right.
Now you can chew. She just got to pass it. But in those days,
chewing gum
was very degrading.
Right.
So you couldn't do that.
I think a lot of that was to show that as a group we could have some refinement or culture, that type thing. But
to
sometimes
be examples of what you can be. Well, if that's what you want to be, but you know, it needed to be put with some sort of affection and love or something,
exactly.
Which it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was just totally the opposite.
Yeah,
that refined, and you know, I try to maintain a certain degree of that, you know, in my rapport now, to show you that you can mix the two.
That's right.
That it doesn't have to be either or.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what happens. I mean, a lot of people find balance in that. But, in fact, again, we used to use the term, probably in a derogatory manner, but we used to call them bourgeoisie, from the French. Really, when I was coming up, the impression that I got of certain people who were just so formal and almost so strict, you know, that they didn't even seem natural.
Now, if you were born into the affluence, black affluence, and there were a few families like you know, the Slater families, and this, if you were born into that, it's a little different.
Yes, ma'am.
when you come into it from the fields, you know, where mm-hmm. you work for sure. the families, exactly. you see. Exactly. It's a different, it's different. Kind yeah. of a mentality yes, there ma'am. Altogether.
Yeah. and so then doing your travels, this brings up to us to about, what, 19, when you were in New York?
That was during the 40s and 50s. 50. Cleveland, New York, Columbus, all that was during the 40s yes, and 50s.
Oh, okay. And you come back to Roanoke periodically to work with your father?
Yes, I never was gone more than a year or two at a time. Okay. And then I came straight back to the Tribune to yes, try ma'am. To put that, whatever it was that I had learned into that.
Yeah. And was the paper growing at this time, or?
It has always been slow growth yes, and still ma'am. Is. Mm-hmm. In fact, bigness has not always been one of our goals.
Yes, ma'am.
I remember at one of the NNPA conferences, I said, bigger isn't always better, mm-hmm. you know. And then they had the Pittsburgh Courier and the Afro-Americans sure. and they had all of these big newspapers and mm-hmm. I said, it's going to be hard on these big papers yeah. when this tide starts turning and then most of them are gone.
Gone. Yeah.
Because when you're small, you can ride different. Mm-hmm. And when you're big, you're dependent on a whole lot yeah. of help, a whole lot of everything to keep you mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. And so those Tribune's still around. Yeah. And when all of these expenses and things they throw at you, yeah. it's hard to handle if you're big. Mm-hmm. So we've always kind of deliberately stayed small enough to handle what I believe in yeah. and what I don't have to. If one of your biggest supporters advertises is somebody that comes out with something wrong, you know, right. you can't bite the hand that's
sure.
feeding you.
Sure.
So I just try to stay small enough.
And independent.
And independent enough, mm-hmm. and so far it's worked.
Yeah, it's worked. It's worked well. let's see. Did you or your spouse or any of your children serve in the military?
Yeah, Daddy was in World War I and served in the 802nd Pioneer Infantry in France and
oh, really?
All around. And then my brother was trying to volunteer. It was during the day, draft days,
yes,
you know, back mm-hmm. then. He wanted to go into the Navy. So he tried to volunteer, but we didn't have any birth certificates, having been born out there in Fayetteville,
yeah,
you know. It
sure.
was a little town in West Virginia. They didn't have birth certificates for black folks.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time he got his birth certificate, he was too, and it wasn't his right age. He
okay.
was trying, had put his age up so he
sure.
could get away from home. Like I said, I was the only one that
right.
stayed there. It wasn't a pleasant
mm-hmm.
setting. So everybody kind of jumped ship as soon as they could get out of there. He wanted to, by the time we got all his false credentials, they said he was too close to his 18th birthday to volunteer. He was going to have to be drafted.
Yeah.
So they drafted him, put him in the army. He wanted to say, they'd ask you what you want, and then they'd give you the officer.
Right.
But they did put him in the Air Force. So, but that's all my father and brother. And there's nobody left but my sister, mother, and me. None of us ever served.
Oh, okay. Do you remember particular businesses or shops around here that
oh,
you utilized?
Oh, my, do I ever. Yeah, there were plenty of them all around. The cleaners, your tailor shops. In fact, it had to be because
right.
we couldn't utilize anybody
sure.
else's.
Sure.
And that's what made the yard so special. In fact, I was writing about it in this week's paper. I brought one in
okay.
to make sure you read. And after the Henry Street Festival,
yes,
you know, for the first years of it, I didn't even attend because I was too crushed with what had happened with
sure.
Henry Street and the way it happened and everything. But then the people involved with it over the years, after it got moved to Elmwood Park,
yes, ma'am.
We started kind of getting involved. And each year, once we started, we never have stopped. And sitting there looking at it, I expressed it in today's editorial. But everything then, because of the days of segregation, were it mostly on the yard, your dentist, your doctors, your hotels, your theaters, even your churches, your everything. It wasn't on the yard, it was in the vicinity, you know, Gainesboro, and your grocery stores, your tailor shops. Everything was there. So that's all we knew was patronizing our own things.
Sure.
We could go downtown and buy clothes in some places, somebody you couldn't try them on, but you could buy them. And different things like that, but we had our own everything of necessity.
Well, do you think, as an entrepreneur, and you hear this all the time in business schools, you know, the need for the black, for there to be an entrepreneurial class in the black community. Now, we once had that. Obviously, things changed with integration and the ability to go everywhere, but, what factors do you think hinder an entrepreneurial class from developing in 2006?
Well, it goes all the way back to the 40s and 50s, Prince, in the days of desegregation, you know. So I don't know if you've watched any of that Eyes on the Prize going on there. The whole revolutionary process is such a distasteful one, you know, and had desegregation been done through incentive instead of, forced, you know, I don't even think it would have taken longer because they had offered incentives to people who did this, they thought it seemed like it would take forever, but I really think it would have happened quicker. But it happened the other way around. Not only, I just know about Virginia, I'm sure, because I was right through the midst of that era, you know, and coming into it in the early 50s and this kind of thing. But in Virginia, when you are forced, you know, forced integration, you see. And I say integration instead of desegregation, because desegregation, that's desegregating your black schools, your white schools, and mixing it up proportionately.
Yes.
We were all integrated into white schools, which, and closed down black schools, displaced black teachers, principals, all of this kind of stuff, we were forced into situations where we were not wanted by the teachers, we weren't wanted by the parents, and the students just reacted to that. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
And through that, when I kind of put it by saying, summarize it by saying, if you've got somebody holding all the cards, forced to deal in somebody that doesn't even know the game, how many winning hands are you going to deal them? So this is what the way desegregation happened. They made them do it. They were determined it's not going to work. And it hasn't. And look at what, it just allowed us to come in where we weren't wanted. And so now, that mentality is still there. We never got rid of that. Frank told us when he was here, and we worked closely with him. A lot of people, they fussed about how much he made. That man, I don't know when he slept. He was around the clock. He could call, if he meets you, he'll call your name. Sees you tomorrow. He knew people. He loved people. He spent his whole time desegregating these schools through incentive, he called it. He put the first magnet schools, all of them, in black schools. If you want these schools, you're going to have to come over here. And he spent his whole time putting Roanoke on the map for magnet schools, which they're getting rid of all of them now, you know. And, but this was, and he said, okay, I succeeded in doing that, but I'll admit I never got off the ground with teacher attitudes. He couldn't deal with that. He brought people in here from Florida with conferences to try to work with attitudes. And this person I knew, I didn't know who he was when he brought him, but he was on the board with me in the office. And he was Cecil Carr, and had been hired in Florida to deal with the same thing with the population. It wasn't black population, it was a different, the
Hispanic
population there being integrated into public school. Same thing they didn't want.
Yeah.
So working the teacher attitudes and this kind of thing, it's a stonewall. And that's where we are today, because all of the schools that were integrated, desegregated, whichever through that, have resegregated.
Yeah.
I walked to work from down Melrose Avenue past Forest Park. That was all white.
Yeah.
And they forced us into that. Now it's all black.
Yeah.
You can count, and that's all the teachers are white.
Yeah.
So, you see, it's not happening just in Rome.
Yeah.
I mean, they're talking about everything else, but they're not dealing with the real problems. And when you're forcing kids out into the street, and that's what it is now, you're making it all so uncomfortable for them. They're not learning.
Yeah.
And you're not trying to teach them.
Right.
That's not the point. You're trying to prove a point here that they're ineducated,
Educated. Sure. So the magnet school concept, where you got an incentive, if I'm interested in a particular subject and I'm a black parent, she's got a white daughter there, she's interested in the same subject. There's an incentive to go to that school.
The dance schools, the aerospace.
Aerospace,
nothing there.
Sure.
And see, it was connected with BPI and the, up there in Fleming.
Yeah.
All of this was connected. I worked with these programs.
Sure.
Let all of them disintegrate.
Yeah.
Never tried to keep it going. I mean, the groundwork was there to really do things, but it wasn't wanted.
Yeah. And so when you force people, you're going to get this resistance.
You're going to get it.
Yeah.
They're going to do it if they have to do it. And on top of that, you couldn't get any assistance if you peacefully integrate schools. No assistance whatsoever. You're on your own.
Yeah.
If you can start a riot, you get riot funds.
Right.
Any amount of riot funds. Right. Now, what kind of picture is this?
Yeah, they created disincentives.
That's
I mean, this is what economists talk about all the time. I mean, you have to have your incentives lined up with whatever your strategic goal is. So if you try to do something peacefully and you don't get the reward, but if you start a riot or start trouble,
you get
the reward. Yeah, then the incentive is to create the problem.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I can go into some, I can go into some proofs of that here in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was listening on, All Things Considered or Fresh Air, one of these talk programs, and someone who worked with the state at that time in Richmond was saying, and I'd never even thought of that, not only did you not get in money from the state to peacefully do it, they were threatened to get funds withdrawn, he said.
Yeah.
If you do it, we're going to cut your funds off. So
yeah.
All of this behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
So you see what we're dealing with then, and we're dealing with the same mentality now.
Yeah, I see. Well, you make a good point. Yeah, you make a good point. Again, I like your analogy about the magnet schools, because then people literally have freedom of choice based on their interests. So there's an incentive to go.
To go.
Yeah, you don't come with all the attitude as if somebody's forced you or pushed you to go somewhere that you don't want to go. I actually hate to see Roanoke City abandon the magnet school concept. And I know that Toda had put Roanoke City schools on the map with that.
No other school in the country had an aerospace school like he had here and had it in there.
Sure.
They made sure that died a natural death.
Yeah.
You see what I'm talking about? Instead of taking advantage of that and putting Roanoke on the map with it.
Ma'am. So we're going to have these antagonisms.
Right.
Yeah, because of this almost coercion.
That's right.
To put people together. Well, that's interesting. I never thought about it in that
context.
And
a lot of people don't think about it. I've been out there in the middle of this stuff, and I know.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not a bench setter. I've been out there in it all the way.
Okay. And Ms. Whitworth, in I think it was in 2004, you were Roanoke Citizen of the Year. And I wrote that column.
I don't know what happened there. It was a pacifier or what?
Well, I wrote that column. And one of the things I talked about was always your calm demeanor, your spirituality. And I did a very imperfect evolution of you as the child of a minister and going to Quaker school and then your involvement in the Baha'i faith. So could you fill in my gaps there? How did you end up in the Baha'i faith? And tell us something about the Baha'i faith.
Well, I certainly wasn't looking for it. It's very unusual that it was on Henry Street, and that there's no community here at any time. I came through street teaching, is what they call, because the Baha'i faith came into this country on this high elite, because it started in Iran, but the persecutions and all of the history of it was so, well, I don't know how I'm trying to condense it into just a little something, yes, but during the Baha'u'llah, the founder of the faith's exile and persecution and imprisonment over a period of 40 years, it was in 1910, after the Turkish Revolution, that they were forced to release all of the political prisoners. And that's when, but over that period of time, the faith had drawn people from universities and all Oxfords and everything, and who recognized who this person was. And so when it came into this country, it came through these universities and that on that kind of a. Yes. In fact, the early Baha'is, when we came in 35 years ago, said you even had to take a written exam in order to come into the faith at time. Okay. Until the grandson of the manifestation said, no, this is for everybody. Mm-hmm. And he says, you're going to have to take this to all of the people. Sure. So that instituted what they call street teaching. And they were going through plantations in this place, bringing the faith to ordinary people. That's where I'm coming from. Okay. They were coming through Henry Street teaching.
Okay.
And it was a little gray-haired white lady from South Carolina and her husband, who was from Benton, and a Persian lady, those three people. And she walked into the Tribune and said, have you ever heard of Baha'u'llah? And I said, no, and I don't want to hear about it, just like that. And she says, don't you believe in love and justice? I said, doesn't everybody? I told you I was a Baha'u'llah. And she just kept trying to talk to me, and I was just so rude. And I was looking at how she was taking me, and that, to begin with, kind of softened me. And she held up a little pamphlet that had a big sun on it that had God in it, and it had rays with Moses, Muhammad, all of the former manifestations, and it had Baha'u'llah at the bottom, the promised one of all ages. And the way that it kind of took the sting out of me, because I said, that's possible. It's what they call progressive, that is only one God that speaks to man periodically, according to mankind's maturity and need, you know. Sure. And I said, that makes sense, you know. And this age seemed to be a different age that required a different manifest. Sure. So then I stopped being mean and started listening to her. And she gave me a little pamphlet, which I was going to throw in the trash until I read it. It was the Baha'i Faith was a new, independent, universal religion whose aim is to revitalize mankind spiritually, to break down the barriers between peoples, and to lay the foundation of a unified world society based on two principles, justice and love. I said, I can't fight that. So I started investigating, and the more I investigate, it's the most astounding thing I've ever known in my life. is bringing all the people across, all the sheep into one shepherd, into one fold with one shepherd. It's always been prophesied, but here is the blueprint. So that's what I started following, the blueprint, and it is working. Believe me. It is working.
Yes,
thank you for asking.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, because I think, I mean, not a lot is known about the Baha'is.
No. Do you know why? Because the whole world is run by religion and politics, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And there is no money in the Baha'i faith is a religious order and a political. And that's why the Ayatollah said yes when the one who interviewed him that doesn't speak well. What's her name? It has the lisp tongue. The famous lady. You know what's the famous interviewer? She's old now. She
Barbara Walters.
Okay, that's the one. She was interviewing the Ayatollah, mm-hmm. and she asked him about putting the Baha'is to death because they were putting them to death by the time.
Yeah.
Yes, and he said, yes, we're putting them to death because they're not a religion, they're political.
Yeah.
Well, I said, he's not all wrong. We are political and religious, but there's no money in either, and that's why nobody is. If you are elected to office, and there's no individual who has mm-hmm. any title or any power anywhere in the faith after Baha'u'llah died.
Sure.
But it's so designed that everything is done locally on elected mm-hmm. bodies of 9 individuals, nationally elected bodies of 9 individuals. And Universal House of Justice on the side of Mount Carmel mm-hmm. and Haifa,
sure.
elected bodies of 9 individuals. These people consult and agree on whatever goes out through the whole, and everybody, and it's all through love. Everything they send you is so loving.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I've never experienced, and it's done the whole world the same in every continent.
Okay.
And we don't have nobody's paid. If you're elected on the local level, the national, or even in Israel,
mm-hmm.
you're not paid to go there.
Yeah.
You're going to have to pay your way there.
Yeah.
Or if you need assistance, you can mm-hmm. get it.
Sure.
But only if you need assistance. Who is going to promote something like all the, look at all the money in campaigning for election.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Now you take all of that out. Who's going to promote a religion that's coming in and saying all this is not needed?
Right. Yeah.
We're a threat to everybody.
Yeah.
And it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And it's working. I wish I had invited, we had a conference at the, used to be Holiday Inn, Quality Inn up down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you could have seen that.
Yeah.
People of all nationalities, races, just in love. We greet each other in love. We don't even understand some languages,
but that
love is a universal language.
Language. Yeah.
And we have a plan that comes from national, a blueprint mm-hmm. that we all have to follow.
Okay.
And it's coming together so unbelievably, mm-hmm. unbelievably, mm-hmm. the worldwide.
Yes.
And look at the time is now.
Mm-hmm.
When it's all that the meek shall inherit the earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just sounds, well, what does that mean? Well, when you see how well prepared, when that thing comes down, and I had no idea it was coming down as fast as it is, then you'll understand. And that's why it hurts so bad about them. Because, you know, our philosophy is not to dwell on people's faults.
Mm-hmm.
They said if they have 10 bad faults and one good, dwell on the good.
Good fault, yeah.
Uh-huh. Good, and then there's some things in there that just shocks us, like it is better to be killed than to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine such a statement? Some of them are so shocking that we just don't sign on the dotted line and we're there.
Yeah.
It takes training in love, and just like they train you in hate.
Mm-hmm.
They got to train you to go out here and kill innocent people.
Right.
You know that?
That's right.
You got to be well trained to go out there and kill folks you don't know. And I found that out when I went to SAC Air Force Command with Lynn Holton. And they took us through this 6 weeks basic training and how you have to train these recruits to go over there and hate and kill people they don't know.
And so you have to train people in love. Yeah.
It's training. It's basic training. Hard training.
Hard training. Yeah.
And that's what these soldiers are into.
And so when in that column I wrote about you, I talked about turtle tracks. So sometimes you mention your faith there, but oftentimes you don't. But there's this almost this philosophy of love, and
it is.
And is that what you're trying to do?
Yes. Every week? And you know what? I try not to write when I'm down or anything like that. I've got to, because the faith is, it brings you out. You're looking the wrong way. Mm-hmm. If you're down, your face is facing the wrong. It's a reflect. You look into that sun, you're going to reflect brilliance, yes, and light. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to reflect. The light, the brilliance, the warmth, the hope, which is not in recording what's going on in the world.
That'll depress you.
It's depressing everybody. It's making people suicidal and everything. You know, to get people in that kind of mentality, and where the haves just keep wanting more and more, and you're so helpless, and when you feel helpless, you do all kind of crazy things. So we got to just turn people any kind of little way, without, you know, flooding them with it.
Right.
Just suggest, please, just look, there is hope, not the way you're looking.
That's what I always find in turtle tracks. I read turtle tracks because I understand, I have some understanding of the Baha'i faith, and I know something about you, so I understand, I try to get this message that you're promoting.
And you'd be surprised at how many people are really getting it. When I first joined this faith, and this was in 1972, and there were no Baha'is here, and I didn't know anything about it, and there was a pioneer here back in the 50s that, she had books in this library, because it connects her to this library. One of the ladies died, and she had a book in her possession when they were getting through it, and it was a book donated to Miss Mitchell here at this library. Those are the Baha'i books, you know, and this lady had it in her possession. There's so many things that tie this faith into this valley. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's really, really, because the guardian who was the last member of the Holy Family to institute the administrative order. Before that, it was all religious, spiritual, in Iran and this kind of thing. Yeah. When it came into this country, the administrative order was added to it, which was very difficult, because the Iranians don't believe in administration kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And Americans don't believe much in spirituality. Yeah. So, but they said it's easier for an administrative person to seek spirituality than for a spiritual person to seek administration. So it's kind of but the tie into this religion, to this valley, is just awesome, because the guardian himself wrote to this lady, Maud Taylor, who was in the Roanoke Valley, and she says, I've been here for years trying to spread the faith and teach, and I have not gotten any response whatsoever. It's just, I'm so disappointed. Mm-hmm. I don't have it. And he wrote back and said to her, and I paraphrase, that the work you have done there, you are not even conscious of it. You know, the fact that you don't see it. Mm-hmm. You're just planting seeds that someday, but he says, once Roanoke, and he called Roanoke by name, and he'd never been to this country. Roanoke is well established. It'll affect the whole South, he says.
Oh, okay.
And so many things. And then when I came in 73, and the first thing I wanted to do was get rid of this paper so I could go teach this faith. You know, and I said, oh, wait a minute. I got a big congregation here. Than any church in the valley, because they got hundreds. Sure. I got thousands of people. But I was afraid to do it. And I didn't mention the faith at all in this Bible Belt. So what changed it was I had a Baha'i lady from Florida who had a column called New Reality, which she just talked about ordinary things from the taking the children to school, this happened and that happened. Whatever she started it off with that would appeal to anybody, she'd bring them out through the Baha'i faith and through some principle that would address, whatever it was. And it, during that, then she got married, and apparently a non-Baha'i, I don't know, but anyway, the column she wrote and said she was going to have to stop the column. Okay. After that, I got calls, I got, even from ministers, what happened to New Reality? Mm-hmm. They missed that column. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, do I dare mention it in my editorials, mm-hmm. you know? So I started just a little bit, but I tried to do more quoting the actual writings, sure. because they speak for themselves, yeah. rather than me taking it out of context, right. and doing something to it.
Now, what year was this that you first started?
That was
mentioned it
in the editorials. Yes, ma'am. I'm really not sure because it hasn't been that long. Well, yes, it has. I go back and look at some of them. I mentioned it periodically, but not consistently as I do now, because the need seems so much greater now, yeah. for you to investigate, and it's now over the web, it's so much easier, sure. to investigate, sure. than for you to come to a meeting that I would have, and mm-hmm. I knew I wasn't able to compete with these pulpits, sure. and them, and you know, this kind,
yes.
but now with the web, it is so much,
yeah.
love and stuff, the beauty and everything out there that will draw people, and it's an organized love is the only, yeah. thing, because hate, love has always been stronger, but it's not organized, and that's what I think I had on a week or so ago. Hate is so organized, and yeah. it looks like it's stronger,
yeah,
because love is just like fireflies, you know, you're mm-hmm. flickering here and there, but there's not enough light on, it's staying on long enough for you to see,
yeah.
But that hate, you can organize that. Hate,
yeah.
And that's why I think that it's intentional, all of these programs they show you to make you keep hating each other, the dogs, everything about the early days of integration, mm-hmm. you know, how they keep pushing that. They don't tell you the good stories of the people that did, and the John Browns that spent his life, you know, for blacks and the,
exactly.
and going to the to the gallows, he's kissing a little. You black people don't even talk about it. You see what I'm saying?
We talk about the hate.
You talk about the dogs. Yeah. Is this kind of thing?
Yeah.
You can sell that hate so easy.
Yeah.
And we got to get this love sold. Mm-hmm. People are going to turn eventually out of desperation.
Yeah.
When there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
But those of us, we're told, who will turn now of your own volition, mm-hmm. the prize is unbelievable. And I know what they mean just every day. The prize is that you're recognizing.
Sure.
That you wouldn't even recognize if you weren't a part of it.
So as the editor of the Roanoke Tribune, you see the Tribune serving a bigger mission.
That's right.
Yes, right.
Not volume or this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But spreading this love, that just getting you hooked on some into some vein.
Yeah.
So that you recognize it when you see it again.
Yeah. Well, Miss Whitworth, we're at the end of our hour. Let me ask you this final question: Is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to share with us?
Not really, because the main thing I wanted to talk about was this school system,
yes,
because
ma'am.
That really bothers me so much,
right.
because the older people are just products of the youth, you
yeah.
see. And if we don't, if we can't do with someone, just like bringing people into the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm.
All emphasis now is placed on children and youth, because we've been battling each other in this faith covenant.
That's right.
Just stop. Yeah. Go to the children.
Work with somebody.
Pure yeah. hearts. Bring sure. these children before. See, like I've been in it 30-some years. If I had brought children in now,
mm-hmm.
they'd be so rich into
sure.
this instead of trying to get work with these adults,
exactly.
which are too old
That's
and
right.
not going to change but so much.
Exactly.
So now, if you can instill this love and respect and humility,
mm-hmm.
that humility, mm-hmm. there's nothing in society that makes you want to be humble.
Mm-hmm.
It makes
yeah.
you look like a wimp or
yeah.
this and all of this stuff. It takes the strongest amount of pride to show humility.
Exactly.
And when I am in the presence of it, I just melt. You know, there are some, especially males,
mm-hmm.
females, anything, and there are some giants that Doug Covington was one
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
in their presence. Yeah. It's nothing you can teach. It's something that you sure. It's a heart-to-heart communication. When you're in the presence of them, you know this is an humble person.
Yeah.
And this is a person who dares to be different, and this, mm-hmm. and that you're going to be persecuted. Yeah. You're going to be he, and you know what he went through up there.
So he certainly did. But you're right. They miss him now that he's gone.
Oh,
I mean they. I mean the students, the administrators, everybody misses it.
This humility, and this is why every time I recite this prayer to people, they want me to. They call, please come. And the Baha'i said, there are other Baha'i prayers other than that. I said, this is the one that reaches people. This is the one that says, please come back and tell me this again. I hope this is, we're at the end of that.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll talk forever. Yeah. You'll be here all day.
But now that's what we wanted to. I told Carla that I know you have great strength in your faith.
Right.
And I wanted to talk to you about that for this recording.
Mm-hmm.
And so that listeners can see how your faith influences your life,
absolutely.
How you run your business and everything. So, mm-hmm. We really wanted to talk to you about that.
And you know, it especially appeals to me, and I think you're born to be whatever you are, and although you don't recognize it, and this is why I think of my life, the way my life has been, has prepared me for this, because there's, I've always been the what do you call it, the black sheep of my family. I told you all of the educated ones and all, and nobody, even my sons, they don't want to listen. You know, they come in to work on the paper. They don't want to hear anything. I've been doing this 60 years. I'll learn. I'll find it out. I'll figure it out. You know, they don't want you to tell them anything. So I've had to learn humility. You know, for the first 60 years, I've been fighting it, you know, trying to demand respect. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm learning, that's not the way to do it, you know. Stop fighting this thing. And this humility, learning to that humility is, and this prayer has done to and it is a kind of an ego. You know, the fact that it's not wanting to be over somebody, that wounded ego is even worse.
Sure.
You know, because you don't recognize it as such. So I think I have done more damage with that wounded ego all my life, trying to defend myself, prove myself. I'm worth being your daughter.
Sure.
I'm worth this. I'm worth that. And it just has turned everybody off. So this prayer, when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame in Richmond, what was it, 99 or something, and that was the first woman from this area, not black, white, or anything.
Yes.
And I had people calling me saying, how in the world did you get to do that? You know, I said, don't ask me. I wasn't on the selection committee. I wasn't the judge. I don't even know who proposed me or whatever. But anyway, Don Beyer.
Oh, yeah.
Von Beyer was the lieutenant governor,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the board of Norfolk State down there, and don't ask me how I got on the board of visitors in Norfolk State and got kicked out of Blueville State College before Thanksgiving, I don't know, because I said, do you know who you're asking? I said, because I'm fooling myself. I said, he said, I know, and I told him, I said, if you know who, you know, my history now, and you still want me on this board, I'll do it. He said, we want you on me. I said, okay, as long as you know what you're doing. I don't want to be sitting up here on no false pretenses.
Sure.
But anyway, they were so political on that board, and I told Harrison Wilson, and at the end, it just got worse and worse, and he had the whole board full of Democrats, and he put on these new ones, and just the whole meetings were politics, and I just said, it's too much, and they were going to give Mary Sue Terry some distinguished award, the highest, Norfolk State's highest award, and I said, your timing's off. She was running for governor, and she had run around Don Beyer, who was lieutenant governor, who was going to run.
Sure.
She jumps out, runs around him, and everybody starts brown-nosing her, and excuse the expression, and jumping on her bandwagon, and I said, you're making a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And he says, but she's done this for this. I said, I don't care what she's done. Your timing is off. Mm-hmm. If you want to honor her, wait till after the election. Sure. And honor her. Don't do it now when she's running for office. Well, whatever. And Don Vi took it so graciously. Mm-hmm. You know, he is such a precious person. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I said, I don't know what you're doing in politics anyhow, because he doesn't even belong in there. He's such a precious person. And so so she lost.
Yeah.
Everybody knows she lost to Allen.
Yeah.
All right. Nobody ever thought that was going to happen. They thought she was. What did he cleaned the house on that board. See, the Richmond.
Sure.
He cleaned house. He said, I even told him you were a Republican. I said, no, you didn't. So you're going to get me kicked out of the house. We can't be Democrats and Republicans. You can't be anything that divides mankind.
Exactly.
Now, we can vote, but we cannot join anything that divides people. We can't preach one thing and do something else, and nothing divides people more than politics.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there was Don Vi running for, I'm bringing this to a point, that's why I'm going back so far. Don Vi was running for lieutenant governor, and the whole Republican slate won. Except lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
Don Vi, well, Democrat, won lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And when that was before that was after this, whatever it was, the Hall of Fame thing.
Oh, yes, sir.
And I had, at the end of it, all of the people, there was a nun there, Don Vi's grandmother. Was inducted at the same time. So he was at the podium with me. And all of them were telling how they got there and who contributed to what, but there was no mention of God in the whole, even from the nun. Mm-hmm. So when I got up there, I just said, well, the eternal flame of many a kindred soul lit my pathway to this podium, but I won't call names because there's too many. And so I said, I'll just leave you with this prayer that did more than anything to get me here. And I recited this prayer verbatim. And when I got through with this prayer, there wasn't a dry. The whole place was in tears because it's humility. The whole thing. And I want you to take a copy of it.
Okay.
And I did this to a church because I did it last year at some program. And they said, please come back and do it again and bring copies. So I fixed these copies for this. And I stood up and said this prayer and the whole place went down. And so Don Barrett was calling my office every day, please give me the prayer. Please. And I didn't even have it on paper because when I saw it, somebody had it on a little piece of paper and I memorized it.
Oh, I see.
So I had to put it on paper and and then I got it to him. Well, after that, every time I would see him in a meeting, he'd start talking about the Baha'i Faith and this poem and what he was doing. And this was during that time because when he won the lieutenant governor, the only Democrat on the whole ticket, his acceptance speech was this poem.
Oh, really?
When I'm fit to be, with patience and gratitude, I've been to the task of the hour. He was quoted that poem.
Oh, okay.
And every time I'd see him, he'd talk about this poem and the house of worship, and he had seen the shrine and the side of Mount Palmer. And he spent half his time talking about the Baha'i Faith.
Yes, ma'am.
And so he said he carried it on his dashboard all the time. So I saw him years later. I said, you still carrying the poem on your dashboard? He said, no, got it on me. Reached in his pocket and pulled it out.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I know this thing has power.
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
That man, the only Democrat on the slate.
He was.
That won.
Yeah.
And there he was, and people don't even remember that.
Mm-hmm.
It was so quiet and so peaceful because he was a good lieutenant governor to a Republican governor. They didn't acknowledge his existence, but he was.
Yeah.
So this faith has so many. And one of the prayers, when I got to that part, it tells us to be as dust. Dirt under the feet of my loved ones. We got to learn how to, and I said, be as dirt under the feet. Whoa, that's taking me down here. And then there was a point that said, what is dirt? What is earth? everything on earth came from it. Everything on earth is coming back to it. And everything on earth is totally dependent upon it in between. So it's the most important thing on earth. And we consider it the lowest form of matter. Your cheapest dirt, your summer's dirt. Isn't that something? So it totally turns your perspective around.
Yeah. Well, that's what spirituality will do.
It is.
It will make you see what you ordinarily won't see.
What nobody else sees, and what you cannot be perturbed because they don't see.
Yeah.
You got to keep your eyes
where
that strength is coming from.
Yeah.
The hill.
And I think when you do that, I mean, that will allow you to be humble.
And then just in the few years, look at how many people. Now, to be a doctor, you had to go through some stuff to do that, didn't you?
I certainly did.
Anybody that had that title. Now, they got people that ain't got GEDs passing out doctorates.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it's happening and ain't nobody saying anything. But look at how fast this works. Everybody's trying to get a title, and we don't have titles. We can't have titles.
Yeah.
This is getting you totally turned the wrong way.
Yeah.
Trying to impress man who ain't going to do anything for you if they could.
Yeah.
See, and the world is just, it's so far gone now.
Yeah.
People, doctors, they can't say a straight sentence. Can't pronounce their names, but they're doctors.
Well, that's what it is. I mean, we're a society that
caught up in that ego. Caught up in
that
ego.
Title and a lot of material things, but there's no spirituality in our society.
Got all plenty of churches, plenty of religion.
Plenty of religion, plenty of churches.
No spiritual.
Yeah, but no spirituality.
You know what? I should have warned you. I'd be here all day. But American Indian, they asked me to sponsor one of these programs on public television. And I did it. But the whole series, the little a Native Indian at the end of it, was worth the whole series. And he said, religion is what you get when you're scared to go to hell. Spirituality is what you get when you've been there.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't that so?
That's a lot of truth in there.
That's saying something. Who's been through more hell than a Native Indian?
That's right. Yeah.
You know, coming from him, when he said that put that whole program in perspective.
Yeah.
All this religion, everywhere. Ain't none of that. Spirituality is what you get when you've been in hell.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Well, and you come out spiritual, I'll tell you. And I try to get there without having to go through that. You know,
it's
up your own. You don't have to go there. Humility can come without humiliation.
Yeah.
Once they get that humiliation, then comes the humility. Yeah. You know, look at these people in Congress now.
Oh, yeah.
They go to jail, they get humility.
Yeah.
See, that ain't no humility. Yeah. That's humiliation.
Yeah.
That's a difference. Yeah. There's a big difference.
Right.
When you voluntarily give up that pride and stuff and come on down, that's awesome.
That is.
That's awesome. Now, that's humility, and that's religion. That's spirituality.
That's spirituality. Well, Miss Whitworth, we thank you so much.
Okay.
And I'm going to keep this prayer.
And
it's beautiful.
Oh, if you learn to recite it. I mean, I don't care what religion, no religion.
Yes, ma'am.
Just read that thing. I'm telling you, because I've been wrestling and trying to love people and love. And see, I didn't come up in love, remember?
Right. Yeah,
it wasn't in my family. It wasn't in my mother's family.
Yeah.
It was just form rigidity.
Exactly.
And then in something else, it was something. But it wasn't no love.
Yeah.
I didn't come up in it. So now you tell me I got to love everybody and I ain't never loved anybody.
Well, and also, I mean, when you were talking about the, you know, you were a woman. You're an African-American, so you've had...
All of these tests.
Yeah, you've had a lot to overcome.
And now I understand why. All of the things, when I first came into this space, it said you have to purify yourself, was the word, of all hate and love.
Mm-hmm.
Purify yourself of love.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, well, I'm already there.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't got nothing to do but turn around. He freed me of the love.
Right.
I try so hard to love boyfriends and all these things.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm some weirdo. This ain't working. Yeah. I don't care whether they come or go. I had three husbands.
Yeah.
I don't love love. It's just different reasons for each one of them. But love didn't. What love got to do with it? Nothing.
Well, I think you have to go through all of that.
You do.
To really.
And then when I come into a religion, say you got to purify yourself of love, which is the hardest thing.
Yeah.
You can possibly purify yourself of hate if you kind of understand your motives and get that.
Sure.
That you can work on.
Sure.
But purify yourself of love.
Yeah.
When you got loving parents, loving children, how do you purify yourself of that? I didn't have it.
Yeah.
So you see, I have been brought up a special way for a special reason.
Yeah. And you're a special lady.
Well, no, I ain't there yet, but I'm struggling.
Yes, ma'am.
And this prayer just touched me because it said, make me a hollow reed from which the pith of self hath been blown. That I may become a clear channel through which thy love can flow. So that made sense to me. And since I started getting that out, God has loved so many people through me that I wouldn't have been nowhere near under any circumstance.
Sure.
And here he is loving these people through me. You know?
Yeah.
It's a whole new world. Believe me, it is.
Yeah.
Thank y'all for putting up with me.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thank you.